Elementary Education. Introduction. We're mostly going to be dealing with HTML5, the latest version of HTML, but there have been other versions, and major browsers still know how to deal with the older specifications. There's a lot of code on the web, so it's helpful to start getting a handle on what you might expect. We're going to talk about a bit of the history, and then we'll do a quick review before diving into lists and tables. It's time to get comfortable with code. A brief history of HTML. HTML wasn't standardized until 1995, with the release of HTML 2.0 by the W3C. But because the web was growing quickly, different developers tried to add their own additions to HTML in the browsers they were programming. The standard wasn't really treated as the authoritative guide it was supposed to be. It was hard to keep track of the different tags each browser implemented. There were a couple of attempts to introduce HTML 3.0, but a new official specification didn't come around until 1999, with the release of HTML 4.01. A stricter version of HTML, called XHTML, was standardized the following year. XHTML was exactly the same as HTML 4.01, but conformed to more precise rules based on another markup language called XML, Extensible Markup Language. Generally, in computer science, stricter rules are a good thing. Stricter rules sometimes prevent tricky mistakes. But XHTML presented some technical hurdles that ultimately were unable to be solved. Developers started to criticize the W3C's process too. People didn't feel like the W3C was addressing future trends in web development. Another group, called the Web Hypertext Application Technology Working Group, WHATWG, was formed in response to the issues with the W3C. HTML5 was released in 2014 and has become the new standard for web development. It has many more elements, supports multimedia and mobile devices better, and paves the road for what the web will become over the next decade, a dynamic, exciting communications network. HTML documents, tags, and elements. We've already seen how a basic HTML document is structured. Let's review that quickly. Remember that the doctype specifies which version of HTML we're using. Doctype HTML is the doctype for HTML5, so this is what you will be using throughout your work. Don't forget to include this in your web documents. Leaving the doctype out won't ruin your web page necessarily, but it could cause the web browser to format some elements in a manner that you didn't intend. The doctype always goes at the very top of your web document. The doctype is not an HTML tag. It's an instruction for the web browser, but it doesn't define structure. Tags start after the document's doctype. A doctype is a part of a conforming HTML document, meaning that the document is written with strict adherence to a specified web standard. An HTML tag is used to create an HTML element. HTML tags are frequently made up of opening and closing tags, but some tags, tags that don't wrap any content, won't have a closing tag. A tag that has opening and closing tags is called a container tag. A container tag is meant to wrap around content, which can be a combination of text and other tags. An empty tag doesn't wrap around anything and has no closing tag. It's just a tag that specifies something, and that's that. A typical HTML tag looks like this. This is a container tag called a paragraph tag. An HTML opening tag starts with a left-pointing angle bracket, followed by the tag's name, and then a right-pointing angle bracket. A paragraph tag will, by default, generate some space around successive lines of text. This is useful because plain text in HTML doesn't count extra space, like line returns or just a succession of spaces, when placed after sentences or in between words. If you want extra space between words or lines, you have to use tags to do so. The paragraph tag is one common choice, even though its primary purpose is simply to indicate a paragraph of text, or in other words, to tag that paragraph meaningfully. We'll come back to this soon. Tags will often be written with one or more attributes, though attributes aren't always necessary. An attribute provides some extra information about the tag that can be used for formatting or programming. Different tags have different allowable attributes, and you'll learn what those are when you start needing to know more about specific tags. An attribute is specified by its name. followed by an equal sign, and then an attribute value, which is wrapped in quotes. Here is our tag from before with an attribute added. Finally, if an end tag is required, it's included by starting it off with an opening angle bracket and then a slash. The slash signifies an end tag. The slash is followed by the tag's name and then an ending angle bracket. An HTML element is made up of the opening and closing tags and any information wrapped by those tags. In a way, you can think of a tag as an enter or exit sign, but an element as a whole structural component of the HTML document, one that includes the tags and the tag's content. The usual suspects. After the doc type, most HTML documents have a pretty familiar set of tags. Using our usual HTML document as a reference, let's break down its tags. HTML, the root element. The HTML tag represents an HTML document's root element, and it wraps around everything except for the doc type. You don't ever see, in some sense, an HTML tag on a web page in a browser, so it can initially be a little hard to understand why it's there. But tags in an HTML document become a part of that document's representation in the browser after the page is loaded. The HTML tag is a kind of starting point for that representation. It's usual for the lang attribute to be specified, along with a specific abbreviation for the document's language. The abbreviation for English is N. Head, for document metadata. Here's where the HTML document's author stores specific information about the page itself. This is where the document's title tag goes, for example. You'll also put style sheet and script links here, along with meta tags, which you will learn about later. A meta tag provides various kinds of data about the web page that can influence behavior or provide information that's useful to clients or developers for programming purposes. It's one of the two tags allowed in an HTML document. Title, the document's name. The title tag is very straightforward. It specifies the HTML document's title, which you'll find in your browser's title bar. The title will also appear in a browser's web history or on search page results, so it can be a very useful way to remind users where they've been. For this reason, a good title is important, and it's better if they're not too long. Body, the document's content. The body tag wraps an HTML document's content. Generally, if you want something to display in the web page, it's going to go in this tag: paragraphs, images, text areas, buttons, and so on. This is the other tag found within the HTML element of a conforming HTML document. This has been a good review of our first foray into HTML, along with a little more detailed information. But there are many more tags to become familiar with. In the next lesson, we'll examine a subset of the most common tags you'll work with when you're creating an HTML document. The starting line. Let's take a look at a more involved web document. Turns out you've had some good luck. A friend of yours is a music producer, and she's getting some local attention. She's decided to create a web page in order to promote her shows and maybe sell some beats. You're a friend and the only web developer she knows, so you get the job. Basic structure and content. All she needs is a basic page to get started, something that has a basic bio and a list of upcoming shows. You're going to need just a few tags to get started. Note that as we look at a few tags, we're going to be thinking sometimes about the relationship between a tag's function and the meaning of the element of the page. By meaning, we're referring to how an element on the page fulfills some role that contributes to the understanding of the document's content. This kind of markup is called semantic markup, and it's a very important idea in web development. Semantic markup emphasizes structure. By doing so, web pages that use good semantic markup will be easier to search, easier to understand, and easier to work with. Moreover, this is a very important idea for accessibility. Accessibility is the idea that the sites we create should be available to as many devices and contexts as possible, including mobile devices, tablets, and assistive technology for people with disabilities. Before we dive in, let's take a look at a quick example of HTML in action. Let's say we want to quickly put up a come back soon notice on a site. Here's how that might look. This is a very basic page, but there are still a few things happening that are important to note. We have the same starting point we saw before, a very basic HTML document with a doc type that specifies our version of HTML, the HTML tag, and the head and body tags that separate page-specific information from content that will be appearing in the page. Within the body tag, we have our first sample of semantic HTML. The section tag defines a unit of content. This tag is used when there isn't another tag that is more meaningful or representative. Here, this bit of content is a little like a sign. There's no sign tag, so section is perfect. It's customary to put a heading right after the opening section tag. This provides a meaningful interpretation of what's to follow. The H1 heading is the largest of the headings by default. Finally, we have two P tags that create paragraph breaks, a bit of vertical spacing, before and after the content within them. This makes our short messages easy to read and to the point. Let's take a look at these elements and a few more with a little more detail. Section, for sections of content with a specific context. This tag defines an HTML element that has a specific meaning, such as a section of content that would be listed in an outline of the page. For example, a portion of the text on our producer's page will be dedicated to the producer's bio. Another portion of the text might be focused on a few positive reviews the producer has received for the past few months. Defining sections of content like this gives us a big advantage when designing a page. Different kinds of content might be styled differently. Dividing documents into meaningful sections might lead to better search results. Web page content will be easier to understand. People who use special technology to read web pages will probably have an easier time navigating the page too. You always want to be as focused as you can be on the meaning that any part of an HTML page is supposed to convey to a user. This is a basic idea in good web development. H1 through H6 for section headings. This is a set of six tags used to create a heading for a section of content in an HTML document. The tag wraps around the text of the heading itself. A few things about headings. First, by default, headings decrease in size, with H1 being the largest and H6 being the smallest, like so. It's best not to think of heading tags as styles for font size. There's no standard anywhere that says that headings must be a certain size. You'll learn how to change heading sizes and any element's font size when we learn about cascading style sheets. Instead, think about these headings as ranks in a hierarchy, with H1 indicating a topmost heading and the other tags representing descending levels of subheadings. This is important for accessibility, too. Certain accessibility tools, tools that help people with disabilities to browse the web, interpret headings as levels in an outline. So it can be confusing to jump from, say, an H1 element to an H3 element because those levels are supposed to mean something. Again, always consider what your tags can mean within the document. P. A P element represents a paragraph of text. It's a pretty straightforward tag, but you'll see them and use them often. Later, when we learn about cascading style sheets, we'll learn how to style them. For now, just keep in mind that it's good to divide a web page's text up into meaningful paragraphs and to use P tags for the purpose. A. The A tag creates an anchor element. It's one of the most important HTML elements because this is how HTML documents link to other resources. An A element looks like this. This would create a link that, when clicked, would take the user to https://www.sumsite.com. The opening tag has an attribute called href. This attribute is given a value, which is a URL, to some other kind of resource that can be another HTML document, an email address, or a file. After the opening tag, there's some text that becomes the link itself. In this example, the words "some site" are linked to a sample URL, but any text can go between the starting and closing tags. In fact, other tags can go inside the A tag. Many elements, including images, can become links to other web resources. There's more to say about the A tag, but this is a good start. IMG. The IMG tag is used for displaying images on a web page. A basic IMG element looks like this. Note that this tag doesn't wrap around anything. That's right, there's no closing tag. Adding this tag to an HTML document will cause the client to send a request to the URL specified by SRC. The server, if it can, will use the URL https://www.example.com/images/snapshot.jpg to find the image and send it back to the client. When the client receives the image will be displayed on the page. The alt attribute is given text that will display in place of the image in the case of browsers that don't handle images. In our example, the text that will display is My Photo. This is important for accessibility, and if the image is important, alt text should always be included. An IMG tag can have more attributes and do some extra things that are important for different clients and different browsing contexts. Again, though, this is a good start. Sometimes you're going to want to make a note in an HTML document, either for yourself or for another developer. The reasons for these notes will vary. One reason for them will be to explain why something has been coded in a certain manner. Another reason might be to indicate something that needs to be done in the future. These kinds of notes are called comments. Comments are ignored by a web client and they don't appear on a web page. In order to include a comment in an HTML file, you simply surround the text you want as your comment with special marking, like so. That's all there is to it. This works even over multiple lines. And this will never appear in the browser. If you have something in your code that's tricky or would be useful for another programmer or even yourself to know when coming back to the code months later, then including a good comment is a smart idea and a good habit to get into. Finally, it's also a frequent practice to temporarily comment out lines of actual code in order to make the web browser ignore them by inserting them inside the special comment marking. The code turns into a comment and doesn't actually run. This is useful when you're debugging a page and you, for example, want to eliminate a part of the code that you think might be causing some problem. Lists, 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 and tables. In order to build our producer's first web page, we're also going to need to know something about lists. Lists are used for many things when making web pages, and there are a few different kinds to know about. They'll each have different applications, both semantically, with respect to meaning, and stylistically. Lists. UL and LI, the unordered list. The unordered list is a simple, bulleted list by default. The UL tag specifies an unordered list element. A UL tag is wrapped around a succession of list elements that are created with LI tags. The list items bullets have a variety of potential styles, which are usually specified in a style sheet. More on that in the next unit. An unordered list is a fairly generic way to group items together. Here's an example. This will produce the following. Unordered lists are also frequently used to create navigation menus. OL and LI, the ordered list. The ordered list is a numbered list by default. It follows the same basic pattern as the unordered list. And here's the rendered result. Ordered lists are used when, as you might well suppose, order matters. There are different options for the ordinal specifiers: numbers, letters, Roman numerals. Ordered lists are not commonly used to create navigation menus. DL, DT, and DD, the description list. The description list is a useful element to get to know. The description list pairs terms with associated descriptions. An example is the best way to see how this works. The above code produces this result. The DL tag creates the description list element. The DL tag wraps around a succession of DT and DD tags. The DT tag specifies a term, and the DD tag provides the description or definition of that term. Description lists are just another useful tool, and they can be styled in many ways. Don't forget, though, that they have their own meaningful context. Specifically, they associate terms and descriptions. It might be possible to use an unordered list for this kind of application, but a better developer will choose the right tool for the job. Tables. Ah, tables. Tables have something of a controversial past in the world of HTML. But before we get to that, let's take a look at how tables work. Tables present rows and columns of consistent data to the user. If you have individual data records, with each record divided into categories that other records share, that's what tables are for. Here are a few good examples of HTML tables styled in different ways. Creating a table is pretty easy with HTML. Here are the tags to use. Table creates the table element. The table tag creates the table element. You'll need this tag whenever you want the browser to interpret the HTML as a table description. The table tag wraps around all other table elements. TR creates a row in the table. Next, your table will have a series of row elements that are created by the TR tag. The TR tag wraps a series of cell elements, as we'll see. Your table has as many rows as it has row elements. Pretty simple. TD, or TH, creates a cell division in a row. The TD tag creates a cell division. For each row in your table, you'll need to make sure that there are an equal number of cell divisions represented. Sometimes, though, a cell will need to span more than one column or row. In those cases, you use the row span or call span attributes, and you specify a value that's equal to the number of rows or columns you want to span. It might sound complicated, but you'll get the hang of it. The TH tag does the same thing as a TD tag, but it's meant to be used for table headers. Again, this is a semantic difference, a way of matching up your code with the code's meaning or intended context. This makes code easier to understand. Let's take a look at a table and see how these tags and attributes work. Here's a simple table to start with. Here's what it almost looks like in the browser. A little CSS styling has been added in order to make the grid lines so that you can see how the cells are being divided. We'll learn more about CSS in Unit 3. Take a few minutes to work out how the code is defining the end result. The code specifies 5 separate rows. The first row is made up of 3 TH cells. The default rendering for TH cells in Chrome is bold and centered. After that, we have 2 more TR rows. In those first 2 rows, the same note appears for both items. To avoid repetition and make things a little more readable, the row span attribute is added to the first TD cell. That attribute will tell the browser to allocate 2 rows for that cell. That means the next TD cell in that column can be eliminated, and that's what we see. The next row only has 2 TD cells instead of the 3 that would normally be expected to make sure everything is balanced and lines up correctly. Something similar happens in the final row. In this case, pretty much any Chinese lunch option is going to be great, so no individual items are specified. The first 2 cells of that row are combined by adding the call span attribute to the first cell. A call span value of 2 will cause that cell to take up 2 columns. Tables can, of course, become quite sophisticated, and there are some table-specific tags that we're not covering here. This is a good way to start, though. Looking at the code for even a simple table will help you get acquainted with the tags. You can also see how larger or more complicated tables can generate a lot of code. In the 90s, early in the days of web development and before modern CSS techniques, it was very difficult to create web pages that, well, looked good. There weren't a lot of options for good page layout, the placement of text and images on the web page. So developers started to use hacks in order to get around the limitations of browsers at the time. Those hacks generally violated what was considered good HTML practice, but the hacks produced much better looking pages. One of those hacks involved using tables for page layout. This was done by dividing graphics into chunks and embedding them into table cells with no margins of any kind, which enabled HTML text to be placed over graphics in interesting ways, and overall, for page layout to be more interesting. That last sentence might raise some questions, and you might wonder when we're going to learn how to use tables this way. We're not. Using tables for layout is a bad idea. Table code can be complicated even with normal table data. Tables lack some characteristics that only CSS can provide. and table-based layout has a bad effect on accessibility. If you're ever tempted to use a table for layout, don't. It's remotely possible that you'll see this technique used on very old websites, but it's a bad practice. Getting formal. You'll find forms everywhere on the web. Sign-up forms, contact forms, feedback forms. Forms represent an essential set of skills for web developers, and like everything else in web development, they can get pretty complicated. Developing a good form can take some work. First, let's remember that a form's basic function is to accept data from a user and then to send that data to a server via an HTTP request for further processing. Let's take a look at a basic form to get started. Ultimately, we're going to be discussing this form. As forms go, this is a great place to start. This kind of form is encountered on many sites, and most of them work in a very similar way. There are a couple of things to keep in mind at the beginning. Form actions. The form tag is used to create a form element, and it has two common attributes that determine what's going to happen when a user submits the form's information to a server. Those attributes are action and method. A form's action determines where the form's data will be sent. The value given to action is usually a URL for a server that will process the data. Form methods. A form's method takes a little more explanation. Remember during the last unit when we were talking about the HTTP protocol? HTTP requests specify methods depending upon how they want a server to respond. There are a number of HTTP request methods, but there are two that you can specify in the method attribute, GET or POST. GET. The GET request method is usually used by a web browser when it asks for a web page. The message amounts to, "Hey, get me this." The HTTP GET request, though, doesn't have a body. So how does a form's information get sent to the server? The client automatically appends the form's information to the GET request's URL. For the sake of illustration, suppose we have a form that submits someone's name and a short message. Let's suppose, too, that when those values are sent, they're referred to as name and message. For the moment, don't worry about why that's the case. The form tag would look like this. Because the form has a GET method, when the form is submitted, it will send a GET request to the server. Let's take a look at a sample GET request to see what we're talking about. In the first line, we see that the form's parameters were appended to the URL. You can see the first part of the URL, which is a path to the server's resource at /some/resource.php. A question mark separates the resource and begins a list of name value pairs. Each pair is separated by an ampersand. Here, the user entered Bob as his name and said hi in the message input area. The server will retrieve the resource at /some/resource.php and will hand over those values to that resource to be processed. Because the form's parameters and values are appended to the URL, they're subject to some limitations. Any value needs to be something that can be represented in a URL. Also, URLs are limited in length. The limitation varies depending upon the browser, but if you have a lot of data that you want to send to a server from a form, a GET request isn't going to work. POST. That's when the POST request comes in handy. Let's take the same hypothetical values that we used for the GET example, but see how a POST would handle them. The form tag would simply specify a different method. And the POST request message looks a little different too. Now our request has a body, and that body contains our form parameters. There are some advantages here. A request body isn't limited by URL constraints to allowed characters or length. Plus, it's a little harder, just a little really though, to see the form's parameters and values, making the POST method a little bit more secure, and again, just a little bit. Using either method, GET or POST, will result in a response sent back from the server. An HTTP response, like the request, will have a number of name value pairs called headers, but the first line, which is called the status line, will tell you what you want to know. If everything went okay, then the server will say so with that first line. Response code 200 indicates that our request succeeded. If something went wrong, then the server will respond with a different code in the status line. If, say, the requested resource couldn't be found on the server, maybe the URL was incorrectly written, then we'd see this in the status line. Response code 404 indicates that our requested resource was not found. There are other codes too, quite a few actually. You don't have to memorize them, but as you progress, you'll become familiar with more codes. And if you think software developers don't have a sense of humor, do a web search for HTTP response code 418. Few web servers will actually return that code, but Google will. Okay, we know a little about what happens when a user submits data through a form. Now let's take a look at the code for our contact form. First, once again, here's the form. And here's the code. There are some new tags here. We've taken a look at the form tag. Let's walk through the rest. Field set and legend. A field set is a container tag that groups form controls together in order to make a meaningful visual connection for the user. In other words, it is the field set tag that creates the lines around the input fields. A field set can do more than that too, but that's how it's being used here. When a legend element is created within a field set, a caption appears by default for the form controls. The legend element should be the first child element of the field set. As you can see, the legend tag is a container tag. Label. A label element connects the label's text to a form control. It does this by supplying the ID value of a form control to the for attribute of the label tag. That last sentence goes by fast, so stop for a moment. Think about it and review the code carefully. In the label for the name field, for example, the for attribute has name, which is the same as the value of the ID attribute for the input text field tag beneath the label. One very important effect of this is that screen reading equipment for visually impaired users will associate the label with the input field, making it easier for the form to be filled in. Accessibility is always important. Input. The input element is pretty essential for most forms. There are a number of different input types: checkboxes, date fields, radio buttons, and so on. They all have different behaviors from each other, so it will be useful, and in fact necessary, for you to get to know these controls pretty well. The kind of input we're dealing with in our form is a text input. This is created by specifying text as the value of the type attribute. Here's an important thing to remember. Input fields will usually specify values for both the ID and the name attributes. In our form, the email field specifies an ID with the value of email and a name with the value of contact email. The ID is used as a way to grab, in a sense, the input field when programming with CSS or JavaScript. We'll see how later. But the name attribute's value is how the server will reference the form's value. To put it another way, when the server receives the form's parameters and values, the form's email data will be called contact email. You could, of course, call it anything you want, though it's best to call it something that's straightforward and that makes immediate sense. Text area. A text area creates a box where the user can enter multiple lines of text. Besides the usual ID and name attributes, it also has rows and calls attributes, which sets the number of text rows and columns that will initially be contained by the text area element. There's nothing magical about a plain text area. It doesn't function as a word processor or have any cool formatting controls. If you've seen those kinds of things on some sites, those are usually text areas, but they have been styled and programmed with CSS and JavaScript in order to add the nice appearance and useful tools. Here, this is just a way for a user to enter a message in the form of a short note. Button. What's notable about this button is that it has a type attribute that is given the value of submit. That connects the button to the form's action. Press that button and whoosh! The user's information gets sent to the server where it's received and processed. There are a couple of small notes about this form. You'll see on line 13, there's a BR tag. This inserts a line break into the document. This is a useful tag, but don't get carried away with it. There are often better ways to insert space into a document. The BR tag is used here to place the text area element beneath its label. Also, in the form tag, you'll see a style attribute with a little bit of style information that modifies the width of the form. We'll cover this more in the next unit. For now, don't worry about it. It's included in order to make the form a little more contained and readable. HTM miscellaneous. We're almost there. In order to round out your introduction to HTML, we need to cover a couple more things. Links. There's more to links than the simple example of an external link that we went over earlier. The A tag knows how to travel different kinds of paths. You can open up new browser windows with links. You can link to different parts of your web page. You can link to email addresses. Links are versatile and powerful. Absolute versus relative URLs. The first kind of link we covered was the basic external link. An external link will take the user to the site in the href attribute of the A element when the user clicks on it. We've all seen this many times. In the sample code above, the entire domain name, www.example.com, is contained in the href. The link uses an absolute path when the href has a link that includes the entire domain name. It's also possible to use a relative path when linking to a resource on your own website. A relative path is a path to a resource relative to the current HTML document's location, according to how the web server is determining that location. Most often, an HTML document's location is determined by its directory. So if you were to write a link in this way, you'd simply be referring to the file named upcoming_shows.html in the same directory as the file you're working on. If you want to refer to a file in a directory one level higher, all you need to do is to prefix the file's name with two dots and a slash, like so. Nice! Two directories higher? And what if you're referencing a file that's in a directory located in your own file's current directory? Then just prefix the file's name with the folder's name. There's nothing to it. Relative links are quickly written, and if you ever change your site's domain, you don't have to rewrite a bunch of absolute links that reference the old domain name. In general, relative links are easier to deal with when developing a site. However, and there's a big however, some developers claim that relative links aren't great for search engine optimization. Absolute links define your site structure a little better for some search engines, as long as you use the same domain when linking to your own site throughout all of your links. Other developers will assert that relative links are fine. Opinions vary, but if you want to be sure, it's probably best to prefer absolute links throughout your site. Search engines will have an easier time indexing your site and directing people to your content. Targets. You have some control over how linked web pages are displayed once they're clicked. This happens through the target attribute. There are a few possible values for this attribute. Self. Load the page in the same viewing frame, a section of a page that hosts outside content, or window as the current frame or window. This is also what happens if you don't specify a target at all. Blank. Load the page into a new frame or window, depending upon how the user has configured the browser. Parent. If there's a parent or enclosing context, like a frame or window that contains the current context, then load the URL into that context. This is probably one of those options that you won't know you need until you need it. If there is no parent context, then this works just like self. Top. Again, if there are enclosing contexts, a series of frames and/or windows that contain the current one, then this opens the clicked URL in the topmost context. You can also supply this attribute the actually specified name of a frame or browsing context if you know that name or you've specified it. Referencing links by name or ID. You can link to other parts of the page you're on too. To do this, you'll refer to the value of another A element's name attribute. For example, let's say you have a long page you're working on and you want to give a user the option to click from an index at the top of the page to a paragraph somewhere farther down. For the destination, choose some part of the paragraph, a heading or the first word, and surround that with a named A element, like so. Then, create a link at the top of the page, or wherever, that references that name with a pound sign. Here's an example. This will work, too, by referencing the ID attribute of an element in the same way. Just precede the referenced value with a pound sign. Email and telephone links. Email and telephone links are straightforward bits of HTML. They simply instruct the browser to open an email program or phone software when the link is clicked. Telephone links are far more likely to be used for sites meant for mobile browsing. Often, though, it's hard to say how a user will be browsing a site. As with links to URLs, the phone number or email address goes in the href attribute. Precede an email address with mail to colon. For a telephone number, use tel colon. Email example. For a phone number. No other rules to worry about. It's that easy. Meta makes it better. Meta tags go inside the head element of a web page. Meta tags supply information about the HTML document itself. In some cases, meta information is essential to the proper loading and operation of the website. CSS files are loaded by the link element, for example. Other meta information can be useful to search engines, web browsers, and other web clients. Let's take a look at a few essential elements right now. Essential. The title element provides, you guessed it, the title of the HTML document. This is used by browsers to load a title into a browser's title bar. It's a very simple tag, as we've seen. The link element commonly is used to link a style sheet to your website, which is a pretty essential function for today's World Wide Web. The rel attribute specifies the relationship of the linked resource, and an href attribute gets the URL of the CSS file. Finally, a meta tag provides a range of possible types of information. One important version of the meta tag, for example, tells the browser to use a kind of character encoding called UTF-8. UTF-8 is a character encoding scheme that will represent the characters from just about every language. Not too shabby. To specify this encoding for your own document, just include this in your head element. This should be something you include in most of your HTML documents from now on. Useful. Search engines will make use of meta tags too. Three that are frequently included by default specify a document's author, description, and a set of keywords associated with the HTML document's information. As it so happens, though, the keywords meta tag isn't something that search engines use often any longer. For that reason, some developers won't bother with it. One reason for this is that keywords were used by less than honest developers to create false associations between content and categories, so that someone might search for one thing and get a page trying to sell them something else. You'll see the author and description tags still. To make your site more readable to search engines, it's a good idea to include author and description tags. The rest. There are many other meta tags and variations on those tags that are used to load various kinds of meta information. We'll cover some of these in coming lessons, and others you'll learn as your skills expand and you read more documentation. Knowledge check. Test your knowledge of new information by answering these questions, and then review the feedback. 1. Which of these best describes how HTML functions? A. Tags are used to organize parts of a web page. Correct. An HTML document is structured with tags that indicate the various kinds of material that it includes. B. Command prompts are used to get user input. Incorrect. Commands aren't the basic element of HTML. C. Metadata is used to define the sections of a web page. Incorrect. Metadata is information that applies to the entire web page, but it doesn't define the sections of it. D. Clients are created. Incorrect. While some aspects of HTML involve a client making a request of a server, HTML's function isn't to create clients. 2. Which of these is the best description of an HTML tag? A. It always has to begin with a capital letter. Incorrect. That might be true in English, but it isn't true in HTML. B. It is surrounded by curly brackets. Incorrect. This isn't the symbol that you are looking for. C. It always has a closing tag. Incorrect. Some HTML tags require closing tags, but others do not. D. It is surrounded by angled brackets. Correct. This is the symbol that you need to use for your HTML to work properly. 3. Why did it used to be common to use tables to customize web page layout? A. It made them more accessible. Incorrect. Actually, it makes them less accessible. B. It makes them load faster. Incorrect. That is not the case. C. It made it possible to create more interesting layouts. Correct. While today there are better ways to create a nicely designed web page, use of tables was once a plus. D. It makes the table less complicated. Incorrect. Actually, it makes a table more complicated. Conclusion. We haven't covered everything there is to talk about where HTML is concerned, but we've covered some important topics nonetheless. If you were to use only the HTML tags we've looked at in this unit, you could build some pretty amazing sites, though you'd need some CSS and JavaScript too. We're coming to those, don't worry. By now, you should know how to structure an HTML document, how to add paragraphs of text, how to create lists and tables, and how to create an interface so that your site's users can talk back to you. That's a great deal of information in a short space. Next, you'll be doing some searching of HTML documentation for yourself, and you'll be putting your new skills to some practical use. We've got a site to build.